Welcome to Agents of Smooch. We are returning to our room with a view, but this time with a modern sexy take from author Kevin Kwan. Kwan also wrote Crazy Rich Asians, which became a major film in 2018. The book adapts the original story from E.M. Forrester into a modern lifestyles of the uber rich and famous. Joining me for this glamorous mission, I have Agent Jean McDonald, who was on our original Room with a View episode. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Annette. I feel like so not worthy of the glamorous quotient of this book, but, and I will say I'm podcasting in my work pajamas right now, but yes. And they're no designer. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. The designer label is Land's End.
I would not be invited to this wedding, but I kind of would like to be, but I don't know. And I also have Agent Sandra Wong joining me, who was on our Crazy Rich Asians episode during our summer vacation. Hello, Sandra.
Hello, hello. Director Wirstra.
Hello.
I'm supposed to say that, right? I'm supposed to make sure I address you properly.
If you don't, I will ignore you. So I will put links to both of those previous episodes in our show notes. So if you want to check out our conversations about both of those, you can check those out.
Please do. Please do.
So Sex and Vanity, which is the novel by Kevin Kwan. Opens with another over-the-top wedding between Isabel Chu and Adolfo Michelangelo Duvecchi in Capri, Italy. You know he's fancy because he has like 12 names. Mm-hmm. 19-year-old Lucy Churchill and her protective cousin Charlotte Barclay are wedding guests, along with an almost familiar cast of characters, including LA indie filmmaker Olivia Lavistock, New Age thought leader Autumn Beebe, and the awkwardly generous Rosamund Zhao and her quiet son George. It is a setting where romance and scandal is waiting to happen.
It was so cool how, I mean, I don't know how much of this is just Kevin Kwan's natural flair as an author and storyteller, but, you know, he really just took that same world that we know from Crazy Rich Asians, the novels, I guess the novel, and then there's two others in the trilogy. But he just took that world and used that as the backdrop for this retelling of Room with a View. I just found that really fascinating, all the different ways he updated it, but it's still so recognizable.
Well, and doesn't he mention one of the characters? I want to call her, oh, what's her name? Begins with an A.
Oh, from
Crazy Rich Agents.
Right. Yes. He does. And of course, I can't remember her name either.
I know. I was just flipping through the book again before we started. And I'm like, there she is. And yes. I've forgotten her name. So
she's the cousin. I just remember she's the cousin.
She's really great. Anyways, so like there's little Easter eggs like that with Crazy Rich Agents as well, which is fun.
It's just, again, this is like insane, over the top wealth. It just reminded me throughout reading this novel, I kept thinking of Dominic Dunn, who passed away a while ago, but he was a novelist, and he also was a columnist for Vanity Fair magazine in the 90s. And it's the same rarefied environment. He wrote in that environment, the uber rich, but he played the role of, you know, sort of like journalist, reporter, the observer, the outsider. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why, but as I was reading this novel and all of the, oh my gosh, all the references to, you know, all of these brand names, I can pronounce them because I can speak French. I can fiddle, you know, muddle my way through the Italian, but I don't know what they are. I mean, I don't know how many people who are reading this novel actually know what every single item and article is, wealthy item or article being mentioned. I don't know how many of the readers are like me who are like, oh, that just sounds expensive. I'm just going to.
I don't buy that.
I don't know what that is, but okay.
Actually, that reminds me that I have a friend who created an app just for this problem.
Really?
Yes. So for designer name pronunciations. Oh, really? I don't have the app because I'm like, I don't really need to do this, but Monique Woodward, who is a totally cool person, and she, it's called the Speak Chic app. And,
well, let's put a link in the show notes.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Let's give Monique a little plug in our
so we can
podcast.
All be fancier in our real lives.
Yeah. And, I mean, in real life, Monique is a venture capitalist and not a designer or a, you know, super rich, you know, show-offy kind of person. She's very down to earth. So, but I thought that was a great idea for an app. And
but if we wanted to fit in at this wedding that we are, of course, yes. going to get invited to, we would have that app to, you know.
Oh, no. I'd be the hired help. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Maybe. I might not even pass that test. I don't know.
I don't know what I would help with, but I would be definitely the person. Maybe I'm just one of those people that they can look down on in the streets of Capri. Mm-hmm.
This might be naive of me, but when I read this book, I read it like this world doesn't really exist in this way, that it is like so over the top and ridiculous that it just feels like fantasy and like fairy tale land and not reality. And I don't know, maybe there are really people who live like this. They are not at all in the scope of my reality. So it's like, maybe they are, but then they are probably actually living in a fairy tale that is no reality. Like they're so out of touch with all of us that their world doesn't touch ours, you know? Yeah.
So I guess, I mean, some people could read this novel and think, oh, I guess you could have this reaction like you're having, Annette, and I think I'm similar, right? It's like a fantasy world. Fantasy setting with strangely familiar elements, or maybe one could read it and go, yuck, right? That's just so gross. I think the tone is more the former than the latter, you know, meant by the author and meant by Kevin Kwan, I should say, because like it's a satire, right? Mm-hmm. Just like Crazy Rich Asians was satirical. All three books in that trilogy were satirical. I think this is the same, but similarly, it also has heart because it's a story about love, which that's what I think it is anyway. I mean, that's why we're on this podcast, are we not?
Yes, it is.
Well, we're here for the love. We're also here for the sex. And I was like surprised. La, la. Like the title of the book is Sex and Vanity. And I'm like, no one would ever know that is a homage to A Room with a View, because even though I have to disagree with your original remark, Annette, that now we're going to a sexy version of Room with a View. I mean, Room with a View is very sexy.
It is.
Just in a different kind of sexy way. And it was a little painful, in fact, sometimes to go look at the new Lucy and say, our Lucy would never have done that.
But I think that's the fun part of making it modern.
Yeah.
Is that what works in the book of an early 20th century versus earlier 21st century has to have a different morality to make the story work, which was interesting. And I was very curious how they were going to do that. So,
And just, you know, also to add, you know, from the real world perspective, the book is very beautiful as an object. Mm-hmm. the cover art is very glamorous, and the just the feel of it, it's like, you know, when you open it up, it's going to be a bag of very beautiful bonbons. And that's how I felt throughout reading it, is that like, this is like, it's like a binge eating of sweet little nothings, mostly meringue, maybe macarons. And I'm here for it because I haven't had anything like this in 2020.
Yeah, I think escapist is definitely like, this is like an escapist, beautiful romance. And I think when I read it, the first time I sat down, and I think I read it in one day, like Saturday, sat down.
Yep.
Through the whole thing, like it carried me along, and it was quite fun and fast and an easy read. And I'm not saying that in a derogatory way, but in a like fun and enjoyable way.
Yeah. If you, I'm sorry, if you hear me making lots of noise, because I'm looking at the note on the type in the back of the book.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is, you know, so perfect. Pierre Simon Fournier Le Jeune apparently designed this typeface.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the 18th century.
Go with just something called Palatino. at least four names were required, but it was very beautiful and readable. And also, you know, I mean, I don't want to keep harking back to the original book, which was also beautifully set and had really interesting chapter titles. Mm-hmm. This book kind of eschews, is that the right pronunciation? Eschews the chapter titles, you know, for more of a like, you know, scene. Here we are in such and such a place. And I thought that worked really well, you know, as, you know, you every time you finish a chapter and you'd see the next description of what was going to be the setting, it was impossible to just stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it had those fun pieces like the wedding invitation printed in like a fancy wedding invitation. And then it had this footnotes all the way through.
The footnotes are the best.
Which are like the direct asides from the author, which were quite fun.
True. Yes. So witty. I really, really, really loved when he would introduce a character and then in brackets it would be their schooling history. Oh my gosh, that was so funny. Because it just mirrors like you're to think that that's how people label one another in that world.
Right. When they would meet somebody new, that little, you know, listicle of their their various schools that they attended would be part of their name in somebody's head.
Yeah, how to categorize people right away? Where are they in the hierarchy? Mm-hmm. You know, compared to oneself. I just love that. It was so brilliant.
And I think another indicator of us as a observer and not a participant, because I didn't understand that code entirely, because there's some of them where it's like, oh, I know like a Brown or a Harvard or a, but I don't know all the nuances and levels of what is the exact hierarchy of what, where all of those schools would align.
Yeah.
And what does that say about you in terms of your positioning?
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is another brilliant app idea. You know, just people could, you know, stand to know those little details and the nuances. I lived in New Jersey and New York for quite a few years, and that's when I became aware of, you know, that step down, you know, in those little hierarchies of, you know, the college, yes, we mostly recognize, but the boarding school or the private school or the whatever school, you know, that's when I met people who had been to those schools or knew about those schools or taught at those schools. And I, you know, so, but definitely the nursery school, elementary school names were mostly gibberish to me as well.
Yeah.
Right. But so hilarious that they would start at like nursery school.
Yes.
But it probably says something about old money to new money, right? Did you go to like some public school or were you at a high class play school and had that like that high end education all the way from the beginning? Or are you an upstart who is like fought your way up into the rich and famous?
And well, isn't it true that in the UK, well, in England, public school is the expensive school?
Yes.
Public school is what we think of as private school.
Yes, it's confusing.
So depending on which side of the pond you're on.
Right? There's a lot of... Well, and because it is a very international cast of characters.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then there is a lot of that sort of at play. Like, I think it would be difficult to know all of it.
Oh, there's another reference in the book, just once about where I can't even remember which character was born. And it was like the only hospital to be born in. And I'm like, why didn't they put the hospitals?
Yeah. Charlotte. Because they are like old money. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the hospitals should have been included as well. I mean, that would have pretty much lost everybody at that point. But it would have been kind of funny to see that as the pre-nursery school entry in their little parenthetical pedigree.
Right. And well, thanks for bringing up Charlotte, Jean. I was just thinking how, so I had not read the Forster novel, the original. I've only been a devotee of the film, the Merchant Ivory production. So I don't recall in Sex and Vanity if there's a description of Charlotte, because it probably doesn't even matter to me, because I just pictured her as Dame Maggie Smith, but modernized for, you know, the 21st century. Right. And I mean, I have no idea what the actual description is supposed to be, but it was just a hoot just picturing her as Charlotte in this book.
She's 44 is what I remember the yeah, one she's point. Much so I was like, oh, shoot, I'm Charlotte Barkley now. Oh,
yeah. I know.
I'll chaperone you. Young ladies.
I had that moment the other, who knows, months ago, when traveling was still a thing. I came home from Seattle with my young charge and friend, mm-hmm. Clara, who is 23, and I've known her since she was a baby. And I felt like Charlotte on the whole trip because I was like,
goodness,
telling her, please, can you go to the dining car and pick me up a Bloody Mary? And which Charlotte would not have done. But also she was like taking care of my bags, and she wanted the room. Sorry, she didn't want the room. She wanted the seat by the window.
Seat with a view.
I was like, of course, my dear Clara, you know, I'm only here because of your generosity. But anyway, I felt kind of old. But then if you're going to be old, be like Maggie Smith in the 1990s mm-hmm. old, that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But all right. So when I was reading it, at the beginning, I was trying to eject all the you know, cast from the film, mm-hmm. you know, from the 80s, right, to try to like see it in its own, you know, mm-hmm. setting and with... And I was having a hard time, but one person I came up with, I'm not sure if I like totally stand by this now, but I thought Anne Hathaway could be Charlotte Barkley. Like, you know, somebody who is, of course, beautiful, but can be makeup'd and hairstyled into looking, you know, not
stern
and fussy. And also I was thinking, if the Anne Hathaway of The Devil Wore Prada, you know, two decades down the line became, you know, a editor and a cultural, you know, whatever in her own right, and she would stop wearing, of course, by now she'd be wearing the couture and not the off the rack from the Gap or whatever. But it still, it didn't quite hold for me. And eventually I was still back with Maggie Smith in my brain.
I like that idea, though, because Anne Hathaway is probably getting to be about...
She's about the right age.
Like maybe a little young yet. But by the time they make this into a movie, which I would be happy to see.
Yes.
Yeah, I could see that. That would be fun. Yeah. So let's talk about Lucy and her cousin, Charlotte. Mm-hmm. They arrive at this wedding. It's like stupid glamorous, and what, you know, we get the whole mapping of that trip to Italy in the original book quite closely in this. But how do you feel about their relationship and how they interact?
It was interesting at the beginning because I felt like they were a little bit more contemporaries, even though technically. Mm-hmm. One was older than the other. I didn't feel right at the beginning that Charlotte was like there to chaperone Lucy, and that. But of course, it became clear right away, you know, that Charlotte was going to be keeping her eye on Lucy, and when things go wrong, Charlotte would be there. But I liked it. Actually, I thought what was interesting, you know, further on in the book is that Charlotte kind of drops out of the picture, you know, and that she, I thought, you know, she and Lucy were like a little bit closer than that in the beginning.
Yeah.
I just liked, for me, I think I focused more the undertones about race. Because, you know, Kevin Kwan had chosen to make Lucy's character biracial, and Charlotte is white. And so that the tension between Lucy, who at 19 is, she really doesn't know what she wants, which is perfectly natural and perfectly normal. But she knows what her family expects of her. And isn't that every teenager's young, you know, new adults? Isn't that the battle for everyone around that age? What do you want? Do you even know? And then against that is the backdrop of your family's expectations. And here is this, this symbol of one side of the family's expectations, very rigid. I found, so the thing for me is when I first watched the film, I was a teenager. I still loved it anyway. When I read this novel, I read this, you know, as a middle-aged woman. And I found Charlotte in, when I was a teenager, I found her so annoying, unbelievably annoying.
Of course.
But now as a middle-aged woman, and I'm reading the novel and I rewatched the film, I adore Charlotte. I love that character. She is just so hilarious to me as a, like a satirical figure. And I love that, you know, the overriding, the biggest thing about Charlotte is how passive aggressive she is. And I adore that about her. And I loved watching that, reading that interplay between, you know, Lucy Churchill rather than Honeychurch and Charlotte in this novel. And how does she deal with that as a, she's basically still a teenager. She's worldly, but you know, she's still young. And Charlotte is, I mean, she's old enough to be her mom, isn't she? Really? Yeah. So this is very interesting for me. I liked that tension there. I did wish Lucy, you know, I understood that she was a bit of a doormat for a reason, but it was a little bit annoying for me. I was just kept waiting, like, okay, when is she going to say something? And but I get it, you know, as a character, that's how she navigates her life, right? As this person who feels unloved, and as we learn later in the novel, abused by her grandmother on her father's side. Yeah. So,
her white grandmother.
Yes, that's right. So, anyway, I enjoyed them, the two of them in Italy together, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, because when you have to add that social pressure when you're really wealthy, where I think there is something a little bit old fashioned about the expectations, because my parents had like a lot less expectations on what I had to be or what I had to uphold. I don't have that sort of pressure, but I think when you get into wealthier classes, there is more sort of pressure on being someone or maintaining something around. Like we say we're modern, we don't have an aristocracy anymore, but I think that we do, and it's based on money. But then you mix in the whole aspect of race in there, in which she already can't quite be what the white side of her family wants her to be, because she's just never going to be white. So we can't pretend she's white. And so then you add those two levels of pressure, and it makes, I think she's holding up a lot and trying so hard to do everything she can to sort of overcome that aspect of her race, which is, you know, really sad for her. And that's probably why she's so restrained, which is like Lucy Honeychurch, but she's so restrained in the beginning of the story, and she's just trying to do everything perfectly. And then in walks a George who's kind of hot.
Let me just, before we go on to the incandescent George now, he's lighting everybody's panties on fire. Mm-hmm. I just want to add too, I mean, that I think here with Lucy's, the pressure is not just that the white side of her family wants her to be white. Mm-hmm. It's that they want her to be East Asian in a very specific way.
Right.
Right. They want her to be like her grandmother wants her to be the China doll.
Yeah.
Right.
And nothing more. Nothing more. Right. She is. So Lucy is constrained by these expectations of what Chinese American is. And that adds another dimension of tension and really heartache. Right. When your family can't accept you, an entire half of your family can't accept you. I just can't wait until we start talking about Marion and Freddie and Lucy, because I adore them. I just adored them.
Well, we're going to talk about them when we go jump over to New York, but we'll be sort of chronological here. any other thoughts about like sort of Lucy and where she's at the beginning of this novel?
She's never met a George.
No.
And you mentioned George already, and I feel like you cracked the egg open on this podcast. And there's really no getting around going to George. You know, throughout reading this, but especially in that first scene in the hotel when Lucy and Charlotte meet George and his mother. And, you know, I'm still a little bit off kilter. I'm like not sure who they're supposed to be until, of course, they offer them their rooms. And I I'm like, oh, of course, it's George. This is George. Oh my God, George is he's, you know, even hotter and more interesting. And you know, I think it's very well done. You know, that they bring him in and you don't know a whole lot about him as a person. Like, you know, of course, his schooling and, you know, his wealth quotient in terms of the number of homes with a ocean view that his mother owns. But he, you know, you don't know what is his, you know, what is his personality? What kind of, is he a good person or whatever? And I love how they unfold that in this story in Capri, what kind of person George is.
I think that that certain opacity to George is because the point of view character is Lucy. We get Lucy's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so how does she see and discover George? And that's part of the, you know, the charm of that love story, I found. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do like that when we get a romance where we get to spend some time, not necessarily in the perspective of both characters, but getting to know both characters. Because I think a lot of times we have where usually the male lead is sort of like that Prince Charming figure who sort of comes in and like sweeps her off and that's it. Whereas this, we actually get to spend some time and have conversations with George. The moment that sort of like melts my heart is when he slips that little poem, line from poem from Pablo Neruda under her door and disappears about the kiss. And I was just like, oh, George, you've won my heart.
Well, you know, and in defense of romance novels, is the best romance novels do that.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
Right? I agree. They do. You have to, because they want the reader to fall in love with each of them too. And I think that's, you know, we see, well, I mean, I certainly fall in love with George. He's just so odd. He's just perfect. Yeah. He's so different. And that's the big thing, right? He is so different from anyone Lucy has ever met, because he's so solidly, unabashedly himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that must be so incredibly appealing to someone who's just barely out of their teens at the beginning of this story, who's just been surrounded by people who are always putting on airs of one sort or another.
Yeah.
And then she's being chaperoned by someone who's so, so deeply invested in how other people see her, Charlotte, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. So that's really part of why Charlotte is so tiresome, unfortunately, right? It's because of that preoccupation with optics, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's easy for us to fall in love with George, I think.
Yes. But I think that that is the piece which makes the whole, you know, so I'm just going to jump right in and say, mm-hmm, like, George and Lucy, they end up having a lovely kiss that mirrors the one in the original story. But then the sort of climax of Capri is, mm-hmm, that there's thrones.
I saw what you did there.
I did. But it is like, so you have this wedding where there's drones all over the place. Lucy and George are thinking they're having a, shall we call it, private moment under her skirt. And the drones captured this on video. And like, part of me is like, well, so what? You know, it's like, ugh, it's just so like, it sucks that your private moment, she's 19 years old. She is old enough to make her own decisions about her own, mm-hmm, body and who she wants to spend time with. But that's the crux moment, is that it's not that it happened, but that it was recorded and now becomes a dangerous piece of information, which Charlotte sees, you know, she's like, basically, this is ruining the rest of your life. And it's like, will it really? It doesn't matter, but because that's what Charlotte thinks, because she cares about perception. And, you know, that's what that perception is, the thing that makes it into a problem, even more than the fact that it happened at all.
Well, and just, I just need to point this out, so I'm gonna, that it's another way that you know we're meant to fall in love with George. Because he sees to Lucy's pleasure first.
Yes.
And with full
consent.
That's
how you know he's the hero in this romance story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's called the female gaze, people. Female gaze.
No, that's,
well,
true.
I think we should try and get away from gendering.
It's true.
You know, right? True. It's the non-male gaze, maybe might be the most inclusive or broad way to say it. Non-traditional male gaze, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the gaze, and we gazed it, and but yeah, like I do love, you know, the scene at the cafe when Lucy faints, mm, and George rescues her, is very caring, again, attentive to her needs, and he doesn't make a big deal out of it, and he definitely. You know, what we find out later in the book, you know, about what triggers Lucy, mm-hmm, makes that scene even more endearing in my heart, mm-hmm, because he didn't need to know what was making her so, I don't know what the word is, like, it's losing her mind a bit. He didn't judge that. He just is like, I'm picking you up and, or, you know, I'm bringing you back to consciousness and take care of you, but not in a let me take care of you young damsel in distress. So I liked it.
I'm sorry, Jean, but I don't recall her, Lucy, actually fainting in the novel. I know she does in the film.
I don't, you know, it's been a while since I've read the novel, to be honest. And I that wouldn't surprise me.
In this novel? Like in...
No.
In the original by E.M. Forrester novel. Does she faint? I think she does.
Yeah.
She does.
Yeah.
She definitely does in the film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, though, in Sex and Vanity, she just runs away.
No, she does. And... She does lose consciousness. She does faint.
Oh, does she? Okay.
Yeah, and he revives her and then attends to the
oh, yes.
The man who is having his heart attack or whatever.
Right. Okay.
What's going on.
Okay.
And
thank
then,
you.
Yeah, no. So he does. Yep.
My mistake.
That's
sorry,
okay.
Jean, you're right.
It's okay.
Well, I could easily be mixing things up from three different sources, you know.
I know, right?
My own headcanon of how I want things to turn out. Yeah, anyway, I do think that was very well done, and it, you know, has the intended effect of Lucy has to reevaluate her opinion of George.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't do it to get her to reevaluate her opinion. He does it because that's George.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the right thing to do. I think it's interesting that Kevin Kwan has made George's profession what it is, mm-hmm. that he comes from this incredibly privileged background of wealth and standing. But what he does is he wants to make a difference in the world.
Another thing that sets him apart from everybody else, right?
Yeah. I mean, unless, do we count Odd and Beeb in that?
I was just going to say.
Hilarious.
Yeah, we should talk about Odd and Beeb.
Mr. Beeb.
That was a really good twist. And I think it captured, what it needed to about the character of Mr. Beeb, regardless mm-hmm. of what century he's in, which is, he's a good person, but he's also, doing things that, promote his position in society. And I liked him. I did like it a lot. So I think that was well done.
Yeah, I think the update from being a country vicar to a world famous, world renowned, alternative therapies,
juice bar owner.
What is it
owner.
Called? The preppy, his chain of yoga studios that he's starting is like, the word preppy is in it.
It is preppy something. Yeah.
One of my least favorite words ever. possibly because, I grew up, in the 70s and 80s. And when the preppy handbook came out, I did not understand what it was about. was really not, clued in until I finally went to graduate school at Princeton. And then I'm like, now the people who called themselves preppy when I was an undergrad at University of North Carolina, they were not actual preppies. they did not go to prep school. They just wore the uniform, mm-hmm. of the various, anyway, don't need to go there. I don't even want to, it's a fashion taste I don't want in my mouth right now. But always the word preppy, it was an epithet, back then as well, or, something of an insult among certain circles as well. But it's just a weird word. And it doesn't, I guess the reason I don't like it in this book is that it doesn't, to me, jive with yoga at all.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the point, right? Mm-hmm. He's somehow melding these strange things. I'm trying to find
what it's the name of a chapter near the end of the book, because I was flipping. I think the second or third last chapter.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, Autumn Beeb. I love how Kevin Kwan just kept the name.
Yep.
Why
yep.
change it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it works.
I feel like this new one would have really good hair, and he's a kind of a little bit hot.
Yes, he'd be a total silver fox. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That is one character I did not have a one to one brain correspondence with the original cast. I was thinking, I don't know. Ooh, maybe modern day Hugh Jackman or something.
But I loved, I loved how contemporary Autumn Beeb had the same interest and curiosity about mm-hmm. the world, but also about Lucy, that he wanted to see what Lucy would do with her life. And he was interested in her as a person. But I don't think, interestingly for me reading this, I didn't get the sense that Lucy really got that. She didn't really understand his interest in her in that way.
No.
As one human being to another. So that would have been an interesting thing to beef up or to explore. But I think maybe, Kevin Kwan wrote it the way he wrote it so he could keep the action going. Because like you were saying, Annette, at the top of the podcast, this book really reads. It's so smooth. You could just shoop. You know, just one day and you're done and you're like, oh, that was just lovely. That was just such a good read.
I liked how they used art instead of music for Lucy. And so, and that he again sees potential in her and that there is a different person coming out through her art and that he sees the potential of Lucy to be that is not fully realized yet when she's 19. And I was like, that's a really believable sort of medium to see that. I think I felt like that worked really well.
Yeah. I wonder too if that's, you know, an expectation in contemporary readers not to really be connected to Beethoven.
Right.
as a, perhaps an Edwardian reader might be.
Yes. Well, and like what style of music would map in the same way that is modern onto Beethoven, right?
So No, I agree with you. Yeah, using visual art was really clever.
Yes.
It is actually kind of a testament to the original book that music was used and obviously you couldn't hear it. Because I was just going to say, well, at least with art, you can describe it, you know, what she's painting and in a more, you know, comprehensive way than you can say about a person playing a piano piece and how it gets them, you know, peevish. And that, of course, in the original movie adaptation, it definitely comes across, but there's piano playing in it. And then in a book, there wouldn't be. So I look forward to seeing, you know, likewise, it's harder to make art something you look at really closely in a movie versus listening to a piano piece. So
And trying to make it that good.
Yeah, so, right.
Yeah. So shall we jump forward a bit? So we have a 5-year break in the novel after the events of the wedding in Capri, and Lucy is back in New York, almost engaged to someone named Cecil Pike, the man that, quote, Vulture and BuzzFeed and The Skim had proclaimed the most eligible man on the planet. And then we enter George and Rosamund, who turn Lucy's world upside down. And sometimes good on paper isn't as good as it first appears.
George and Rosemary?
Rosemary. Is it Rosemary?
Rosemary. I'm just saying that because I keep wanting to say Rosamund as well.
Yeah, Rosemary. Okay. Enter George and Rosemary.
I love the proposal.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's just jump right into that proposal.
That is like, that's a masterpiece of like, you know.
Redonkulous.
And also, I mean, so many things have gotten like over the top in terms of things like proposals, you know, for young people these days, if I can sound so ancient. But, you know, just down to, you know, the thing that I never had heard of until, you know, the last 10 years is a promposal where you can't just ask somebody to the prom. You have to have a whole
no pressure, like, people
strategy. So of course, reading about Cecil creating some kind of, you know, spectacle in order, you know, to make a proposal to Lucy, I was like, this is the, you know, logical result of where things have gone in terms of like showing off and also Instagrammable moments, which is, I love that that's threaded throughout the whole book. If this book does nothing else, it should make people look twice at Instagram.
Yeah. I'm just at the part in the book where Cecil is introduced, and it's Cecil, bracket, Kitty College Preschool, South Elementary, Kincaid, Eglon, Oriel College, Oxford. Which means nothing because he's just a jack.
I think, too, that we, if you recall back when we were talking about Love Actually, I believe it was the three of us that were saying, don't do public proposals.
Yes.
I have a strong stance against this because it's a lot of pressure. Like, how does one say no?
Right.
To that.
The situation was a little bit different with Lucy and Cecil. I mean, I think, I don't know, had they been together the whole 5 years or certainly for
a little while.
For a while.
Yeah, and, I don't know. Well,
it's still, you know, like, I hate it.
You just kind of expect it where, you know, just in Love Actually, the fact that Mark was going to show up in France and propose to Aurelia was a surprise to her. I mean, Jamie. Sorry.
So many characters.
Sorry.
I also think it's a great example of, like, a proposal that was for Cecil mm-hmm. and yes. not for Lucy.
Yeah, aren't they always?
Yeah.
They're always for whoever's going to propose. Cecil, who's Army Hammer Handsome, trademark. I love it.
Before we were talking, or if he started this, I sent you a picture because I was like, how big? It's 49 yeah. carats.
Wow.
Because that's way too big. It's like so disgusting.
I mean, is that's the ring that's $26 million? Mm-hmm. Like, who wants mm-hmm. $26 million? Well, first of all, anywhere in your house where you could lose it, but on your finger, walking around with it would, I don't know. Obviously, I am not of the milieu that would yeah. wear a ring like that, but it's mind-boggling to me, which I think it's intended to be, obviously.
Well, and it becomes a thing, right? Because she yes. doesn't yes. wear the ring all the time because ever. It's so big. And
she
then
never wears it.
He doesn't. He's always asking her to wear it, which I feel is a little symbolic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the point.
Well, and he needs the insta moments, you know, mm-hmm. with the ring and, like, and also showing off to his, I don't even want to say friends, you know, his coterie.
His followers.
His followers. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
His followers. I did love that you get to watch that proposal from Freddie and Marion's point mm-hmm. of view, mm-hmm. and they're just trashing mm-hmm. it.
Yes. Yes. Freddie is so lovely in this book. I just like, every, you know, enjoyed him a lot, and I like the original Freddy as well, but this is a different, more sophisticated cultural mm-hmm. observer, and he is the perfect, like, pal for his mother to be standing there watching this proposal
yeah
unfold on Fifth Avenue.
I really, really so I'm so glad we get to now talk about Marion and Freddie and Lucy, because I just was so touched by their little family dynamic, mm-hmm. the three of them, because I recognize that. I know that they're, you know, Freddie and Lucy are raised in, you know, obscene wealth, but Marion comes from a more modest background, right? Mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. think she's quite as wealthy.
Nope.
She's extremely accomplished. She's intelligent as all get out. She's her own woman. Is she? I think she's a doctor. Is mm-hmm. she not?
She's definitely educated, smart, self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the three of them as a little family unit, I recognize that. I recognize the affection. I recognized, you know, the Chinese son hanging around with his mom because they love each other and they're cool with one another and they like each other's company. I just, you know, I'm lucky. I have a bit of that with my mom. Is we just hang out sometimes. Well, in the before times, when I could travel, because she doesn't live here. Mm-hmm. It just that, you know, that just comfort with one another to just do whatever, and then also teasing the third person, ganging up, just in a really loving teasing way, right? Ganging up on the third person in the little triangle, and it switches which two it is, right? It's going to be the siblings against mum, or mum and one of the siblings. I found that really touching and really believable.
Yeah,
and that Marion had that with her children, even though her children, you know, grew up in worlds that Marion, you know, she did not grow up in, and she had to learn how to navigate herself as an adult after having married. And I've forgotten the husband's name, the one who's passed away.
Mm-hmm. So have
I. Is it Reginald?
I think that is their grandfather.
Oh, shoot.
Like the great okay. Reginald Churchill. I think that's, okay. or is that her? I can't remember. Sorry.
Right? I don't remember him.
Need to take more notes on the names of sub characters.
Yeah.
This is a book. This is a first novel where I wish they had an index.
For names.
Because there's like a family lot tree of characters
and locations. Yeah. You know, like mm-hmm. what I wanted. oh yeah, I wanted to look up, you know, a particular scene. And I'm like, if there was an index, it would say, you know, movie theater here and page whatever. So anyway, but yes, I think I agree, like, that they're a really lovely family unit. And I think that's what we're led to, you know, believe is the only way they can survive in this otherwise very Church Hill environment that they live in, you know, because everything that they do, where they live, where they go to school and all that is much more the, in the, you know, the circle of their, deceased father's family, not their mother's family. And that they're like a really close unit, I think, because they can do that together. As you say, they can mock gently and with love other members of the family. And that's a good thing.
So then why Cecil?
That's always the question, isn't it?
Yeah. I think because he's safe.
Yeah.
But he's shallow and he's safe. There's nothing unknowable. So compared to George, which, you know, that the subtext is Lucy is comparing everyone after George to George. Cecil's the exact opposite. I mean, you know, handsome in his own way, but he doesn't have depths. He is not opaque. He's transparent. And whatever he's thinking, he's saying. And I think that that is more comforting for Lucy at this time in her life. And yeah, and also she's smarter than he is. She can maneuver around him when she needs to.
She could probably also ultimately control him as his mother controls him.
Yeah.
Which is not very sporting of Lucy.
No, but I think his mother thinks Lucy is controllable. But I'm like, if they had stayed together, I think Lucy would be the dominant force in that relationship over time.
He wouldn't even know it.
No, he wouldn't care.
He wouldn't even have a clue.
Yeah, well, as long as it was on Instagram.
another of those like ridiculous fantasy moments, which just made me laugh quite a lot, was the house that the Cecil house is designing in the middle of New York. One, I was like, how is this possible to exist in the middle of New York? And how do you get a canal into your house? What? I don't understand how this is working.
Tri-level vanishing pool.
Like, yes. Yes. But I'm just, like, I just, like, it's ridiculous and hilarious. And I would like to see this. I would not like to live there.
No. The show kitchen versus the real kitchen in the basement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That is so funny.
Horrible. I mean.
But it's not done to live in. It's done to showcase, because they probably, like many other characters, have many houses. And this one is their New York showcase where they probably stay for a short period of time here and there as they whiz around the world. So you don't need to live there.
Yeah. Mostly it's just to get into the pages of whatever.
Yeah. You know.
Architectural Digest. I don't even know if that's still a thing. Yeah.
But I think it does get to that theme that is in both the original and this novel, is that Cecil sees Lucy as an object.
Yeah.
And a status figure. Then he sees her.
Yeah. Just like the emerald he buys for her hand, she is the bauble for him. Just another one, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, the canal, which a gondola and a gondolier is supposed to, you know, also clue us into Cecil's deep connection with Italian culture, which is very important to him. And he's so connected. He's just going to plop Venice right down in the middle of a house in New York City.
Cecil. Oh, Cecil. Cecil. Dear Cecil.
I'm curious. Then there's, never going to be a way to answer this question. But I agree that Lucy, had she married him, would have found a way to cope with him. But he still, I don't think he was ever going to be, talked out of buying super big expensive things.
No.
All the time.
No,
and showing off, and absolutely insisting on showing them off, which was not her way at all.
I think she would have just allowed him to do whatever he wanted and then found ways to not do what he wanted her to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then in contrast, we do have George reappearing on the scene and really flustering Lucy because she doesn't know what to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
She's having feelings.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. Well, and that's another thing about her relationship with Cecil. She has no feelings for him. She has nothing to be flustered by except his insistence on certain things, I guess, the ring. But yeah, she has no feelings for him that need containing or understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So delicious.
Yes, I love that they turn up. I love the Hamptons setting mm-hmm. for all this.
It's the Preppy Guru Lounge.
Thank you.
There you go.
I knew that there was
lounge.
Yep.
There were buzzwords in it, and I just couldn't remember. But yeah, the Preppy Guru Lounge, located in the Hamptons. I like seeing George, and I also like seeing Rosemary. And I would say, Rosemary, her character, was a big surprise to me in this book, and how much I liked her and how she made things happen and how she connected with people. She was not as two-dimensional as many of the sort of secondary characters. She was really mm-hmm. a force for feeling and wisdom and all this, all rolled up into this incredibly eye-catching eye-assaulting package.
Eye-catching. Oh, yeah. I adored Rosemary. I adored how she's just like George. I mean, that's how you know where he got it from, right? She is firmly herself. She's only ever herself.
Yeah.
And the one time she is in the novel convinced to dissemble and be someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, she's not very comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives up, the application to that exclusive co-op. But she's just, I just love how she connects with Marion and that they, they become like sisters, like BFFs mm-hmm. over just where they are, where they're positioned as women of color in a world that's predominantly white, that we see, right? We don't know the homes and places and society that Rosemary comes from, right? Which is in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
We can guess. We can guess what that world is because we've already read Crazy Rich Asians. So I guess we have that in the background, right? That's where Rosemary's from. And so it's kind of interesting to think, because when you're reading that other trilogy, Kevin Kwan's first trilogy, you know that world and you're like, oh yeah, Rosemary can easily be situated there.
Mm-hmm.
But then he plucks his character from that world into this world, which is very WASPy and American and elitist East Coast. And then what does she look like from those people's perspective? Or mm-hmm. in Italy, how she and George are been friends for ages with these super exclusive people in Capri. That Mordecai is giving a tour to their home, and Rosemary and George just show
beautiful.
Up.
Mm-hmm.
That was so great.
Yeah.
And how, because people who connect with Rosemary, they connect with how authentic she is. She's just like a lovely, friendly person who wants to mother everybody, right. Which is why Charlotte is so taken aback way at the beginning in Capri when Rosemary insists on switching rooms, right? Yeah, it's so great. And Rosemary's and Marion bonding over how to raise Chinese children in Western societies and cultures. I really, really enjoyed that part.
When they were cooking dinner together. It's like, oh, I love that scene so much. It's just like, too. I want to come and eat with you all.
I know.
And they seemed like the most real characters. And Rosemary starts as a caricature. And then becomes so much more than that as the novel progresses, which is so fun.
I have to say that meal where they have Peking duck and Cecil is like, I don't have anything, but I don't know, what did he say? Like, skin on my plate. And it's like, and it was like a moment for everybody else to be like, he doesn't know. He doesn't know the first thing about this, vaunted, traditional delicacy, and he should learn a little bit.
But I think that's the thing, is he doesn't care to learn.
I mean, I felt superior to him.
That's good. Like, dude. Let's talk about the falling apart of Cecil and Lucy and the reunion of George and Lucy. What do you think breaks them? What's that final break for them?
Well, I think, of course, it's now that Lucy is faced with George in the flesh, she can't stop comparing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's become more and more apparent how vastly inferior Cecil is. Unfortunately, poor Cecil. But also his callousness. And how he is so embarrassed by Lucy's family,
right?
And so when they're in whatever restaurant it is, I don't recall, but he's insisting that one of his assistants, nameless, because he goes through so many, he doesn't bother remembering their names. He's ordered one of them to go back to the home to find the ring so Lucy can put it on, so he can drag her over to somebody and introduce her with the ring on her hand.
Yep.
And they're trying to have a talk about a fundraiser for an animal shelter. And Cecil refuses to help, even though the person they would like to get to be a spokesperson and like the guest of honor to attract all the people to the event, he knows her. He directly knows her, and he refuses. And he's like, well, your little thing is too tiny for her. And he's just such a complete shite about it. And I think... it's indefensible in that moment. Lucy just is like, there's no way I can, I really can't defend that. And then the ring comes, and then she lets herself be dragged away. And I think it's just too much for her. She realizes this is going to be the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just the last straw.
I think it was really interesting too, like when it breaks, she does the whole, I don't want to tell anyone, because she knows if it gets out that George will know. And she doesn't, she can't admit it to herself. Mm-hmm. And, but she knows he will know that that's why. But then they do the whole, the final moment is actually between Rosemary and Lucy, mm-hmm. and not between George and Lucy, which is so interesting.
It is a direct homage to the original, because Rosemary is Mr. Emerson. Much flashier. And, she probably has more hats than him. But I loved how they did it, though. It was, and I loved that it was her, Rosemary, because she is, she is herself, and she's honest, and she cares about her son so, obviously so much, but she cares about his happiness, but she also cares about other people. And I liked, I also liked that they brought in that coveted guest for the
mm-hmm. without Cecil,
mm-hmm. right? That Freddie was responsible, for doing that, which was beautiful, but also that she ends up being kind of the the little oracle to say, like, you're only deceiving yourself, you know, about something that she had overheard, and, you know, and that Lucy was trying to win her over. And finally she just said, look, I'm just going to be honest with you right now. You sound like a jerk and you're only deceiving yourself. And then even in the book, you know, that keeps being echoed in Lucy's mind. And I think that's a lesson for everybody, you know, when you're trying to talk yourself into something because it seems good on paper.
Yeah.
That the only one who is being deceived is you.
I love that's the choice before Lucy, right? She's been told the truth. George told her the truth about Cecil.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then just in, you know, mirroring and echoing the original, she uses the same words when she's breaking up with Cecil, but she still can't admit who told her those words. She still can't admit how important George is to her. But then, as you say, it's kind of clever. It's a tiny bit of a cheat, but it is also clever to have this completely unknown character pop up at the end and tell Lucy she's being a complete jerk. But then Lucy has a choice, right? And she really does. She could continue and give up on the one true love, or she could risk everything and go to George. And so I love that always has to be the choice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to choose, be brave and choose love, or do you want to be safe and choose, I don't know, something else, some facsimile maybe?
Well, and really what is keeping her away from George is merely that fear of perception of other people judging her, of other people being embarrassed, and like ultimately who cares, right?
Yeah.
Like, why does that matter so much to you? But it is, when you're in the middle of it, it can feel really hard to have to face the judgment of people who might be talking behind your back or judging you or thinking, you know, and to go from the most eligible gentleman on the planet to who's this George? Could feel like a
super
lot.
We know. He's a super hot, wealthy.
Super wealthy. I mean, he's not as rich as Cecil, but he apparently has, like, you know, the bank account to fly over a band first class, you know, at moment's notice for the fundraiser.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's amusing, the notion that you would have to think, you'd think that being with Cecil is less embarrassing. Or that he would embarrass you less.
Right.
So true. I mean, that ring is embarrassing. And she knows it. That's why she won't wear it. And in addition to, like, it's probably heavy and I wouldn't want to lose it or damage it. But,
well, you would be cutting people all the time with that sucker.
Hit someone in the face with it.
Right? You both side the same way at the same time. So perfect.
It's because we're at the end of the story, and it does, I really never thought about it before, but there isn't that, like, you know, Lucy and George moment of going like, I'm sorry, it was always you. I always was in love with you. Like, whatever. Nope.
No, we get them in an epilogue.
A nice epilogue. Back in Capri. Thank you. So
we're getting close to the end of the episode, and I want to know, how do you feel this maps on as an adaptation of the original novel? And I'm going to say the movie, because the movie is so iconic. And I think the reason a lot of modern audiences, me, for example, know the original novel.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel it works?
I think it works pretty well. I mean, it is not thinly veiled.
It's not thinly veiled.
It's not veiled at all. But it does give you a few, you know, for those who really know the original story, it gives you, you know, some nice Easter eggs, and that I like that. And I really hope they make this into a movie. I will definitely go see it because I want to see who they do cast.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a great adaptation. I mean, as I said, I'd never read the Forster novel, Room with a View, but I, from the film, When I read this novel, Sex and Vanity, I kept remembering scenes mm-hmm. from the film and mapping onto, oh, this is that kiss. Oh, right. This is when Charlotte, okay. You know, and it was so enjoyable. So, so enjoyable. And I think because this adaptation is so contemporary, mm-hmm. It absolutely works as an update. If you've never read the original, you would want to. You might want to go back and read The Forester and see, oh, okay, so what was different in Edwardian times? I mean, a lot, clearly. But I did think it was interesting, like, when Kevin Kwan kept the names and when he changed the names.
Yeah.
I wondered, I don't know if – I haven't Googled any articles or anything, but I wonder if he ever speaks about that, like, why it's not Eleanor Lavish. It's Olivia.
Lavistock.
Yeah, Lavistock. So, like, what does that mean? Does it mean anything? So things like that. But it's fun to see the differences, and it's just so enjoyable to read the similarities.
Yeah.
So, and I would definitely love to see this adapted into a film.
I agree. I, like, know both the book and the movie quite well. I would say, actually, if you've seen the movie, the book and the movie are very closely related, the originals. Mm-hmm. And if anything, the book is actually a little slyer and more humorous and has probably a little more of that satirical humor at the class structure than you get in the movie. So I think in that respect, the books kind of have that similarity where it is a little satirical towards class structure. So yeah, so I would say if you've seen the movie, though, you're going to have a good understanding of what the book was, and that's not going to impede. But both books, read both books, watch the movie, do it all, just sink yourself into it. I like that it's so different that it just becomes more fun. I would rather see something that just goes for it instead of trying to be too honoring of that. But I mean, in terms of the structure, there is like so many scenes that you're like scene that are matching with the original. So that's fun. And as someone who knows this story so well, it's hard for me to even think if you haven't seen the original, I think you would still like the book, but I can't detach them. So I can't take them apart in my brain. So I think you would still enjoy it even if you haven't read the original or are familiar with the original, but go in the other direction, go see the movie. So,
yeah. I would love to also find out more about why he chose to make Lucy and George multiracial and what that meant to him. So I have to look that up, see if he ever talks about that in an interview or something.
Yeah, because it is quite an international cast, which is fun. But the story does add some depth, but I don't think you could have done this story without that element, but I think it does add some interesting pieces to the characters. And I would imagine part of it would be the original trilogy release was in a large consideration was the audience of Chinese Americans, Chinese Canadians, people who live here, have grown up here. So it makes sense that he would try to connect this story to a similar audience who is probably, you know, part of his fans. And he is also born in America or born in Hong Kong?
No, he's from Singapore.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So that is very interesting why he would.
Yeah. He's Chinese Singaporean. So, you know, in Crazy Rich Asians, the character of, oh my gosh, blanking.
Rachel.
Is it Michael?
Michael.
It's Michael Nick. And Rachel, Nick. Right?
I remember that because that's my husband's name. Nick.
Yes. So Nick's family is basically Kevin Kwan's family.
Okay. Oh, so that's really interesting. I would have assumed because I do hard research when I go into these episodes. I would have assumed he was American.
He did. I believe he's moved to the States. Okay. He moved to the States a while ago. So he does live in the States, but originally he comes from a very wealthy family in Singapore.
Okay.
Apparently they moved to Houston when they moved to the States, so I thought that was a nod to have Cecil from Houston. And I did read a really interesting interview with him and about how he became aware of ultra rich people, even though he, you know, went to a private school. He didn't really know the ins and outs of all the brand names because he wasn't in that group.
He needed that app.
And that what was interesting is that when he came to the U.S. and then, you know, mixed in with a crowd of WASPy people, feeling like he was more at home, like their homes were decorated, like, you know, in sort of an Anglophilic way as things were in his milieu in Singapore, that he had more in common than you would think with the white characters in his novels as well. So I will, I'll give you that link as well. It was really interesting. Because I didn't know. I didn't know that much about him. I had only seen the movie Crazy Rich Asians.
Well, it's fun. I enjoy sort of, and you know, like, I think that's one of the things about taking this story from the 20th century into the 21st is also bringing in a more diverse cast than just all wealthy white people. So let's have some wealthy, not white people. But I do like that it wasn't just an inserting of a person of a different color, and that had no impact on the story because it did affect their characters and create a different story. So I thought that that just makes it more interesting.
And of course, now that we're at the end of this podcast, I remembered the name of the character that shows up from Crazy Rich Asians. It's Astrid.
Astrid, yes. Now we can end the podcast.
Yes. Thank goodness. We didn't end the podcast yet.
We're just tied up all the loose ends now.
Do we have any more? Awesome. We got them. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking about this book with me. I really appreciate getting to, you know, bend you all to my will. So thank you, Sandra.
Thank you so much, Annette, for making this possible. Giving me a great excuse to read this novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice to have my little club of book reader, romance readers. We can have a regular book club meeting.
Yay!
And thanks, Jean.
Thanks, Annette. I'm glad I read this book. I don't know if it would have, gotten to the top of my pile without a homework assignment from Agents of Smooch, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think it was a fluffy, you know, souffle of fun to enjoy, even if I didn't know a lot of the references, being not wealthy or certainly not ultra wealthy.
I'm not even fashionable. Like, come on. That's not our mission here. Well, we will see you again soon in another mission, Agents. And until then, stay safe. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network. If you are enjoying our show, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the Smooch Agency, you can become a member of the Incomparable at theincomparable.com/members. Members can choose to support us and any other shows on the network, and you get extra perks like hanging out in the members-only Slack channel and bonus content such as our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. Thank you for listening. Your next mission will be coming to you soon. Thank you.